today is Wednesday. I just discovered that. December 21st, 2022, and it is 2:45 in the afternoon. Hi again and happy holidays. This is Sean Williams, and you have found the Mincing Rascals podcast. Please share it with your friends. And give us a good rating if you don't mind or if you think we deserve it. You can listen to this podcast broadcast in part Saturday nights at 8 o'clock. And you can hear me on WGN Radio weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Heather Sharone of WTTW News.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel.
That's it?
That's it. I'm not going to mess up your podcast anymore, John. I've decided I'm going to reform myself. I always derail it. I always say something like the splenetic publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, and then we're off.
You've done it that way every single time.
I know.
And today, by not doing it, you're ironically messing up the flow of the podcast.
I know.
Our friend Brandon Pope's going to join. I know, right? Brandon Pope's going to join us in a little bit. I thought you were going to say, just by way of referencing the day, that today is the last day before the big blizzard hits the Chicago area, and everybody is sort of making plans or changing plans. Our news click at the radio station was, have you changed your travel plans? And one in four of them said they have had to alter it because of what's supposed to be maybe just a few inches of snow, but 50-mile-an-hour winds. And we will go in one day from a high temperature of 30 to 3.
It looks like the morning of Christmas Eve is when things are going to settle down again. And Heather and I were talking earlier before you came into the studio, John, about the possibility that travel on Saturday will be okay, and it'll be get out and about, and it's going to be Friday where we're all going to be stuck at home. My daughter wants to drive up to Minneapolis to tour John Williams' old homestead, she was going to go on Friday, and now is going to delay it till Saturday and hope for the best.
Yeah, no kidding, because they're going to get it like us too. We were talking on the radio about big snows, which this probably won't be. It'll just be a big weather event. But I like the big snows. The times when we pulled up the 10 biggest snowstorms in Chicago history, four of which happened in a 10-year span between 1929 and 1939, by the way. But when we do get a monstrous snow, don't you love the business of a neighborhood clearing it all out and shoveling each other's sidewalks and pushing cars out of drifts and things like that?
Oh, yeah, I definitely do. I think there's something very exhilarating about that, about a blizzard and people, especially when you don't have to go anywhere.
Yes.
It's a little easier for people who have these sort of white-collar jobs where you don't have to get out to say, oh, it's so great, and you get to get out and help your neighbors and stuff. But there are people who are seriously inconvenienced by it, and people who will die in these events. So yeah. It's hard to be flip about it, but I know exactly the feeling of like neighborhoods come together often at moments like this. They shovel each other's walks. We have some snowblower heroes in our neighborhood, which we just love them because they get out with their snowblowers and they go up and down the street. And
Lou Manfredini, who does, of course, shows at this radio station, owns a couple of hardware stores in Chicago. He sold at one of his stores 8 snowblowers yesterday, just like people like. I was driving around town looking for generators, whole house generators.
You can buy a 3-year supply of freeze-dried food as well.
I've already got duct tape from New Year's Eve 1999, so I'm pretty well stocked with some of my survival supplies.
Well, it's a potentially politically perilous situation for Lori Lightfoot, because she is sick with COVID-19, so she is in isolation, which is why you have not seen her at any of the various and assorted news conferences that city officials have had for the past couple of days, pledging that they are ready to not only plow Chicago streets but protect its residents from the ravages of the winter. And I imagine her somewhere, you know, furiously dialing the commissioner of streets and sand and the commissioner of the Department of Family and Support Services, trying to make sure that the city is ready, because there is nothing that a Chicagoan hates more than being stuck on unplowed streets 2 months before the election. She is behind in most of the polls that we've seen, and I don't think anybody would argue that she has any margin to sort of not sort of fully and robustly respond to whatever the weather brings to us in about 24 hours.
And historically, if you can't get the snow plowed in Chicago and you're a mayor, That does not bode well for you, right?
Yes.
It's not.
It's the Blandic effect, right?
That's right.
And every mayor since then has lived in fear of that. Although it didn't help that much during Snowmageddon in 2011, right? When Lakeshore Drive got...
That's because Daley was not running again, and Rahm Emanuel and the other candidates were not in office yet. So there was really no one to blame for that.
Is that right?
Snowmageddon shut down Lakeshore Drive, where people would get out of their vehicles. It was such a whiteout and so much snow, they got disoriented and didn't know where the lake was and where the city was. CTA buses were stopped and spent the night there.
It really is radio's time to shine, though, isn't it? It's radio becomes extremely vital during storms like that.
There are some events where you can feel the listeners, and that is surely one of them. Since we're talking a little bit about the city and the mayor's race, or the mayors, why doesn't Willie Wilson, who is one of the top candidates for mayor, it appears right now, Lord knows he's spending as much as any of them, why doesn't he reveal his income taxes? He said he didn't want to. Should a mayoral candidate do it? And why won't Willie do it?
Willie Wilson has said, basically, it's nobody's business how much money I pay to the federal government in taxes. And he said it shouldn't really bother anybody because he gives away so much money to help people with groceries and gas and to pay their property taxes. So he essentially is, you know, his line is, you don't have to worry about it. It doesn't matter. I'm not beholden to anyone. And this isn't something that you should concern yourself with. But it's of a piece with Willie Wilson, who says he voted for President Donald Trump in 2016, but has declined to say whether he voted for Trump in 2020. And he has also declined, at least as of a few months ago, to say whether Joe Biden was the properly and fairly elected president.
Really? I didn't notice that. He's dodged that question? Willie Wilson?
Yep. It was a very tense moment when he launched his campaign and I asked him that question, and the people surrounding him heckled me to the point where a couple of other reporters sort of leaned over and said, let me know if you want me to walk out with you, because it was a very, very tense moment. So this is in line with sort of his not really a Republican, but certainly not a Democrat approach to these sort of issues.
I will weigh in and say that I think that there ought to be a federal law, that anyone running for federal office, Congress, Senate, any cabinet appointees, high court nominees, and so on, they all ought to have their tax returns made public, because their financial interests and their investments, their entanglements are the public's business. When it comes to county, and I think statewide offices should be the same. It should be a state law for counties and cities. They ought to make their own laws about it. And I would think that a city like Chicago would say that, yeah, we want to see 5 years of tax returns. And I think that it talks again about where the candidate's priorities are, where the candidate's investments are, all the things that I think are the public's business when they want to hold important offices of trust. So, but I guess the question you're asking, though, John, is do average people, average voters care? Is that going to be enough to say, well, I would vote for Willie Wilson, but I haven't seen his tax returns? I don't know the answer to that. I do know that Donald Trump played fast and loose with his taxes, telling everybody that he was being audited, that he couldn't release his tax returns because he was being audited, which wasn't even true, as it turns out. He was clearly trying to hide things there. And then again, he also was elected president of the United States, having refused to release his taxes. So the question is, whether is this a new normal that politicians or the candidates can just say, no, none of your business, buzz off.
I understand why you don't want people knowing your private business. I don't want people knowing about my finances and my taxes, but I'm not running for mayor. I have no potential entanglements. Actually, there's rules at our company and laws that govern what things I can accept and then what do I say about it on the radio so as to disclose any potential conflict of interest. There's plugola and payola rules, which are too often ignored. Well, I don't know if it's too often ignored, but they're often ignored. You would think in a city that has so many entanglements with private business and members of the city council that it would be apparent why we should know where their money's coming from. If, I mean, your income taxes would demonstrate your income as well. You know, we shouldn't know that, but we should know that you're not corrupt, and that's how you demonstrate that. So I don't care how much money you made. I don't even care how much taxes you paid, but I can't know if you're being honest unless you reveal that.
Candidates have to file what's called a statement of financial interests with the Chicago Board of Ethics. And that gives us some sense of whether they own a company that does business with the city or if they're earning a pension or a paycheck from another government entity. But beyond that, the information is very, very limited and is of limited use for reporters trying to figure out, well, did this alder person vote for this because it benefits them financially?
Yeah.
And it has been a long time sort of source of consternation by watchdogs and good government advocates that saying we can't make sure that there's no pay to play going on here because we don't know how these elected officials make their money. But there's very little ability for the state to pass a law saying that you have to do X before you run for office because, of course, it gets into constitutionally protected rights of association. So we are really in a situation where this is one of those norms, right, where we rely on sort of the shame and the appropriation to convince candidates not to do this sort of thing. But whether that's still a logical sort of way to operate in 2023, I think after at least President Donald Trump's first term,
right,
I think very much an open question.
But your point then, pardon me, Eric, if I just may clarify this with Heather, and that is your point then that we shouldn't need a law, we don't need a law, that it'll be so damaging to any election that you're going to release your taxes because you can't win otherwise. Pre-Donald Trump, that was the thinking on it, right?
Yeah. Pre-Donald Trump, that was absolutely the thinking. And it held through even through Richard Nixon. And then it was sort of this post-Watergate sort of burst of reforms that put in sort of requirements like those statements of financial interests. The question is that are those reforms and laws that are now at this point almost 50 years old, are they still enough to protect democracy and give voters the information that they need? I think that's an open question.
I just wonder, we are allowed to have, a state law that says you can't hold a state office or municipal office in Illinois if you've been convicted of a felony.
So it's not just any felony. It has to be a felony that is sort of disreputable. So there's
the worst kind of felony.
Right. Is that right? Is that word in the law?
Yeah, yeah. So, for example, former Alderman Procol Joe Moreno is running for the first ward seat that he lost back 4 years ago. Since then, he's been convicted of a variety of felonies and has pled guilty to other felonies. He's currently facing a ballot challenge saying that those convictions, which he says are no longer on his record because he completed a diversion program, shouldn't count against him.
But I'm just wondering if it is in fact unconstitutional to put some sort of requirements, some sort of disclosure requirements on candidates. I mean, I assume they have to file these statements of financial interest that you talk about.
And, right. And
so if that's a requirement, why can't you make something else a requirement?
Well, sure, that's the argument. But then if it's a local municipal election and this is governed by state law, there are separation of power issues by saying that you have to disclose information that is required by another branch of the government. So
I think you shouldn't be allowed to run for office if you don't agree that Joe Biden is president. Forget your taxes. Like the first time you voted for Trump, I'll give you a pass on that. The second time, you ought to at least tell us and then maybe we can judge accordingly. But if you still can't say that Joe Biden is the president, then
is there anything else going on in the mayor's races right now, or are we just in sort of a lull before the new year?
Well, it's a little bit of the pre-holiday lull, and I want to be clear that I am not opposed to that lull, and I would like it to continue. I think sort of the biggest issue right now is public safety. And I wrote a piece for WTTW sort of looking at what it means for all of the candidates that Chicago is likely to end 2022 with nearly 700 murders again for the third year in a row, which is truly it's not an unprecedented level of violence because things were much worse in the early and mid 90s, but it is a significantly long stretch of a very violent time in Chicago's history.
So are you seeing a lane for Paul Vallis then? Because he's the one who's put out this multi-point plan to fight crime.
Yeah, he is not alone in putting out a multi-point plan to fight crime. Sophia King has one. Cam Buckner has one. Chuy Garcia says he will have one after the first of the year. Paul Vallis, I think, is running as, along with Willie Wilson, as the most conservative candidate in the race. He is explicitly pro-police. He has said that he wants to end the COVID-19 vaccine mandate for police officers. Paul Vallis says, look, you can do both. You can have a proactive police department that protects people's constitutional rights. However, in Chicago's entire history, there has been no evidence to suggest that such a thing is possible. And I asked him whether he doesn't risk emboldening officers who resent these rules, who resent these restrictions, and sort of implicitly give them the high sign to go ahead and do whatever they think needs to be done to keep Chicagoans safe. And that is how we get into a situation where we pay somewhere in the neighborhood as taxpayers of upwards of $100 million a year to settle misconduct suits.
And is it true that Mayor Lightfoot's going to say, well, gee, there were we've had a 12-15% reduction in homicides in Chicago? There were more than 800 last year. So if it hits 700 this year, it's still an appallingly high number, but it is coming down.
It's like the interest rates.
I've heard them talk about that in news conferences as the year goes by. Like, shootings are down and homicides are down, and people are like, "Yeah, but it's still awful. It's still like, let's not get too cocky about this." So the 700 murders a year or homicides a year is appalling.
Yeah. So in 2019, there were about 550 murders in that year. So I think that gives you a sense that, while we're certainly not at the peak of, you know, the crime and violence problem as it was during the height of the pandemic, we haven't even gotten back to pre-pandemic levels. And I don't think that candidate Lightfoot in 2019 saw that as an acceptable level of violence. So she is in a real pickle, essentially, and not to make light of it. But if the violence was not acceptable under Rahm Emanuel in 2019 with more than 500 murders a year, I think she has to answer, well, why do I deserve re-election?
Well, this came up in last week's podcast, and I just said that I don't know that I'm going to vote for a candidate based on that, although that's terribly important to me. But I just don't believe any of them are going. So then you put somebody else in the mayor's seat. Is it going to go to 500 that year or the next year or even in during their term? I don't know. I'm not convinced that this sort of conditions that create this level of crime are going to be alleviated by a tough-on-crime mayor. By golly, if we put Willie Wilson or Paul Vallis in there, then it'll go to 400. I don't believe that for a second.
Well, as we talked about last week, the person who ran in New York City as the strong anti-crime pro-police, a strong anti-crime pro-police candidate won that mayor's race. So I think there is some sense out there that crime is a salient issue.
Oh, I'm not saying it's not. I'm not saying it's not. I believe people will vote around it. I'm just like, okay, then you get somebody in there who you say, well, I didn't like him about this or this or this, but he was tough on crime. He's going to support the police. The police are going to catch the people or try that murder people, but they're still murdering people. I think the remedy to this is a long-term progressive series of reforms to make people's lives better. And you've already turned off the radio now. People don't want to hear that. I mean, that's not tough on crime.
I asked the mayor if she was going to have sort of a new plan or sort of a new policy for a second term. And she said, essentially, no, we adjust every day. We do what needs to be done every day. And she also said that she was eager to take on candidates who she said had, quote, aligned themselves with the defund the police movement. And she's specifically referring to Chuy Garcia and Brandon Johnson there.
Right. If you remember 4 years ago, Gary McCarthy and Paul Vallis both ran that sort of tough on crime campaigns, and together they wouldn't have made the runoff. I don't think. I mean, it was, so and well, if you had Willie Wilson in, you probably get enough to get the runoff. But I don't think Willie Wilson's support is based on his anti-crime policies. I think it's based on generosity. And
yeah, right. Eric, what is this? Dildos, butt plugs, oh my, Project Veritas, and Francis Parker School in Culture War dust-up. I told you guys before we went on the air that I saw that but didn't click through because I couldn't believe what I was reading. But then I saw a Marjorie Taylor Greene video pop up, and that sounded ridiculous, too. Was she talking about this story, and what is this story?
I believe she was talking about this story, and essentially what happened was that back during Pride Week earlier in the spring, there's a 30-minute session at Francis W. Parker School, which is a private elite school in
High
Chicago.
School?
Well, I think at Parker it goes doesn't it go all the way from grade school through high school? I don't know. I'm not sure what years. This was not for pre-K students. This was for, I think, 14 years old and up or something like that. But there were only six students in this. It was an optional session at a private school, and they did a show and tell with certain sex toys and talked about the difference between spit and lube and things like that. And Project Veritas, which is this undercover right-wing journalist group that goes around and tries to play gotcha with liberals and Democrats, got the dean of students who had been part of this presentation to sort of talk about it, and he was sort of proud of it because he thought he was talking to a fellow educator. And this video went live on social media, and Parker got a lot of hate on social media, including a bomb threat that closed the school on Monday. And we're not positive that it was related to that. I guess we don't know that it was related to that, but that's what happened there. And you know, my take on it is that at a private school and an optional session for six students, if that's a problem, it should be a problem that the parents of those students should be addressing with the administrators. If it's a bigger problem at the school, it's the problem that the parents at the school should be addressing with the administrators. As someone who doesn't have a student there and it's not a public school, I don't feel like even I should have an opinion about this. It does seem to me like students these days of a certain age with access to the internet probably know about butt plugs and dildos and don't need to have them passed around to school. But I don't see the necessity or the benefit, but I also kind of don't see the harm.
Well, I see the harm. The fact that Project Veritas got a hold of it, they embarrassed you.
I'm just talking about the session itself.
Well, no, I think you make your case pretty well that, yeah, if under those circumstances, what's the harm? If the kids wanted to sign up and if the parents have an issue, those six parents should maybe take it up with the school. It's a microscopic number of people, and I don't think any harm was done to the kids. But if you were an administrator and I was an administrator at that school and you said, hey, I think this will be a good idea for the population that wants to attend, I would say, no, let's not do that. Let's not do that. I mean, would you've recommended that the school do that if somebody had asked you?
I would have voted no on the show and tell part of it, but I wouldn't have had to be a hill I'd die on. I mean, it's like, I don't think that's a good, really good idea, but again, it's not something I would feel particularly strongly about.
So well, it strikes me as a little bit like and a little bit not like a drag show at a library or a bakery or something like that. You can do it and it's empowering or helpful to a certain community, but at the same time, you don't have to do it. And you should at least be aware of, in the culture we live in now with the internet as it is, I see a lot of downside.
So this is not like a well-intentioned complaint. Project Veritas is engaging in what amounts to a public and well-funded effort to demonize gay people. And I don't think that it is that we are required to sort of participate in that and sort of pass judgment on whether this was a good thing or a bad thing, because this was not brought up by a parent who was upset. This is a private school, and there have been no complaints by anybody associated with Parker, but this is an outside group that is exploiting this session, which I will give the administrators and the parents the benefit of doubt and assume that they thought all of this through. And they are seeking to exploit this to demonize gay and transgender people and are attempting to make sort of political hay out of this.
Somehow, I'm just wondering if they should have anticipated that, in fact, political hay could be made out of this. It is a different set of circumstances in that this was a surreptitious group who hijacked the event. But say some parents had taken exception to it.
If we're going to say that being gay or being transgender is sort of like inviting abuse and is sort of like,
that's not what I'm saying.
It sort of implies that, because if these students, if the school decided, look, this is a service or a class we want to provide to our students, but we're not going to because we're afraid that it might create a political problem, that is a disservice to those students. And we are allowing those people, targeting vulnerable people, gay people, lesbian people, transgender people, and we are hurting them because they are being targeted by people who want to target them because of who they are.
Now, I take an old school attitude about what schools should do. You don't have to invite this issue.
So Parker is a private school. There's no indication that any of these parents were upset with what their students were, their children, what they were exposed to. We are essentially saying, yes, Project Veritas, you uncovered something that I personally am uncomfortable with.
I'm not uncomfortable with it. All I'm saying is, are you surprised that if a Project Veritas gets a hold of this, or if just say a half a dozen parents complained, would you be surprised that this thing would roil up into some sort of controversy? Would you be surprised by that?
I don't think you can separate how it became a controversy from the controversy itself. This group targeted teens who are gay and lesbian and transgender, and somehow implying that the school is engaged in child abuse, and implying that the very act of teaching gay kids, teaching lesbian kids, teaching non-binary kids, teaching transgender kids, that there's something shameful or wrong about that. That's what they're doing. And it's not okay.
Like, you're assuming that you know the motivation of, say, me. All I'm saying is, I want those kids to go into that school, get a good education, come out of that school. There's a million things we're not going to teach them about for a million different reasons. Like, we don't have the time, or we don't have the space, or we don't have the interest, or we don't have the experts. And we could dream up a whole bunch of stuff that we're not going to do for a whole bunch of reasons. And I would just put this on the list of things that if the kids go 4 years to the school and graduate from this school, never having had exposure to this session, we will still have done a damn good job potentially of educating these kids. They will not suffer for the absence of this session.
Well, yeah, and of course, the other issue is that it's hard to tease out the response that they have to just having a session that is accepting of gay, lesbian, transgender students, and ones that and passing around the sex toys, which is, I think, provocative for this kind of social media firestorm. I don't see that. If I were an administrator, I would say, let's not pass around sex toys because that could be seen as encouraging kids rather than explaining. And the job of a school, I think, is to explain and to but that may be where the error was here, if there was an error, which is that you end up creating a controversy where there shouldn't be one. And I agree with Heather. I think like 85-90%. I think that it's important for schools to have this kind of education, have this, and foster the kind of acceptance and dissuade bullying, the kind of thing that goes on with LGBTQ students. And you can do that, I think, without having the kind of presentation that excites controversy like this. And so that you make Project Veritas look extremely stupid rather than half the country or whatever thinking, yeah, boy, they're grooming these children for sexual activity, which is absurd and offensive. But there you are.
If somebody reaches out to me and says, look, I've got this really explosive secret information, I want to give it to you, I want you to do a story, part of my job is to evaluate that source's motive, right? What do they hope to get out of giving me that information? And it's clear that Project Veritas has an ulterior motive. They are not here to help ensure that kids are protected. They are here to hurt gay and lesbian and transgender people, full stop. I don't see why we as a news media or people just talking amongst friends should participate in that. I just don't. I think it was malicious in its intent. There has been serious real world repercussions with bomb threats. And I just think it's abhorrent that we are allowing them to cast this pall on what I have no reason to believe was anything other than a well-intentioned, well-structured, thoughtful class designed to help teens.
I agree with everything you said about Project Veritas. I'm just wondering out loud about the wisdom of hosting an event like that in a world that a Project Veritas exists, or some parents would draw a controversy about.
It's a really close step from that to why even be out as a gay person, or why even transition as a transgender person, because I will be attacked, or my family will be attacked, or maybe somebody will post mean pictures of me on the internet. It's not even a hop, a skip, and a jump. It's a half step from that.
Well, with all due respect, says you. I mean, like, I know what my values are and my attitudes are about it, and I'm just being super pragmatic as an administrator. I think it is a longer step. I think it's a leap that you did not need to take. But you and I are in different places on this one, Heather. Eric, you have a list of questions that, are you going to post this on the Picayune Sentinel, your annual sort of predictions for 2023?
Yeah, that will be in Thursday's issue of the Picayune Sentinel. I have a 30-question list of, predict the news for next year. I do this every year. I've done it for many years. And the reason I do it is not because I think it's possible to predict. Obviously, every year is different, and news always surprises. This last year, I confidently predicted that former House Speaker Mike Madigan would not be indicted, and of course, very shortly after the turn of the year, I was proven wrong. What I do is I ask these questions, and I sort of invite people to talk about, to think about the stories that we are going to be looking at. What's going to happen in the coming year? We're going to elect a new mayor in Chicago. So I'm asking who's going to win the race for mayor. I'm also asking who's going to be the runner up, because I think we're almost.
That's a good question.
Have a runoff. I want to know if Superintendent David Brown is going to keep his job. I've asked that question for 3 or 4 years in a row now, however long he's been.
Well, he
around.
Won't if Chuy Garcia wins, it sounds like.
Or anybody else. Lori Lightfoot. Yeah.
Well, hold on a second, Eric. So just if I may. This is your part of the thing, but like, who will win the mayor for Chicago? If it was today, a reasonable person would guess Chuy, right?
Well, that's what I'm guessing, and it's a guess.
But then who do you think is your number two? If Chuy wins, is Lori Lightfoot number two?
I think it's Lori Lightfoot is number two, I would anticipate a runoff between those two. That would be my best guess, but I think anything could happen in the next 2 months. I don't want to put Heather in a box. I know Heather doesn't like to predict, but I'm just wondering what stories is Heather going to be looking at?
Well, I guess it'll still be 2023 when then former Alderman Ed Burke goes to trial in November. And yes. So I guess it'll be a big question whether he's convicted or whether he even goes to trial. Does he take a plea deal now that he is no longer in office? I tend to think that him taking a plea deal is not the prediction that I would put my money on if I was a betting woman, but I am not, as you guys pointed out. I think that the other question is what happens to the public transportation system is something I'll be watching very closely, because really more than any other governmental agency, they're very dependent on COVID relief funds. And we've not seen ridership return to the point where they can sort of be self-sustaining once this federal aid ends. And a lot of it is going to be spent by the end of 2023. So are we looking at service cuts? Are we looking at fare hikes? You know, what happens with all of that? And I think that also goes for the schools.
Eric, you also asked in this, is morbid, but it's so germane. Will we have more or less homicides? Will be above or below 700 in 2023? And I'm going to say below, because I want it to be below.
There's a little bit of wish.
Hate
to predict them. Well, I also ask about COVID deaths, so that we had about 270,000 COVID deaths in the U.S. last year, and is that going to be worse next year? It was certainly down from 2021, but what does the graph look like on COVID? I'm looking at Russia and Ukraine. Is Vladimir Putin going to stay in office? Are they going to sign some sort of peace accords there? Is Kevin McCarthy going to be reelected to that post, the House Speaker that he's running for? These are all
questions that listeners can answer on your Picayune Sentinel survey, right?
Right. Yeah, they're 30 questions, and what happens is the week after this, I'll say what do readers think, and then I'll say what I think, and then we save them for their year, and then at the end of the year, 2023, we look back.
Can we do this one? NASCAR officials expect 100,000 people to attend the July 1-2 first and second auto race around Grant Park on the museum campus. How many people will attend? So more than 100,000, less than 100,000? I don't know, but my news click the day after is going to be, was this worth it? Right? So say there's 200,000 people, and the 10% we get of the profits of concessions, was it all worth it? And I'm going to already predict that people are going to say no.
These are cranky WGN listeners, though.
Look, we can only know what we know. And right now, we just know that on paper, it's going to be a long disruption setting up for it over by Grant Park. I think that's what's going to bother people. So when that thing is finally over, who knows how long before they return the streets and clean up the Buckingham Fountain area, people are just going to say, be gone. Right.
And the Sun Times has a pretty good story. I think it's today. Is it today? They had a story about how people are looking at this going, I don't know, the contract. The Sun Times BEZ got a look at the contract and said that it looks really pretty sketchy. So and I'm predicting that they're not going to get 100,000 people. That would be my guess, that that's a vast overestimate. I just don't see it. It's a novelty to watch cars drive around the museum campus in Grant Park, but it's not an actual NASCAR. NASCAR races are run on huge ovals, and that's not what this is. So this is sort of a weird Grand Prix NASCAR mashup, and I just don't think 100,000 people are going to come to Chicago.
Will we see passing? Will we see really high speeds go, wow? Or,
I don't know. Boy, is that cool. God, you like soccer too, John. It's like, I will concede that the World Cup final last week, Heather, we had this debate whether the World Cup final was going to get more or less viewers than the Sunday night NFL game, the regular season game. And I thought the NFL would, and I was wrong about that. The World Cup did have more ratings. So I have to yield to the wisdom of Austin Byrd and John Williams.
Yeah.
Well, it was a fantastic game. So you got hosed. Wait,
the NFL game or the soccer
the World
match?
Cup game. Yeah.
The NFL game was pretty good too, and they didn't have to decide it with a skills contest at the end either.
That's Eric. So Eric's not done the complaining about it though, and now now his thing is, okay, so you got more viewers, like a lot more viewers, but Eric doesn't like. I think it's a fair point. A quadrennial event ends on a kicking contest.
It's the rules of the game. Everybody who started playing knew that that's what would happen if it was tied after the end of extra time. So those were the rules of the game. Everybody loves the rules of the game. They follow it as it is.
It's right. Fair. Both teams have a goalie. And by the way, the goalies were really good. Although, as Eric pointed out in his piece, the shootout, is that what do they call the kickoff thing that they do at the end? It's really a guessing game. For the goalie, do I go right or do I go left? It's kind of like a coin flip. But during the regulation play, some of those goalies were really making outstanding stops. The value of a goalie, I thought, was clearly demonstrated in the final.
Yes, John, I need to correct you. They're called keepers.
Keepers. Yeah. Keeper. They're not called goalies?
They're called keepers, and they don't play on a field. They play on a pitch. And that's all I know.
But the thing that I saw, that guy, he was really good at it, whatever the heck he was doing or whatever.
They are amazing. Those athletes are amazing. Messi is one of the most amazing athletes I've ever seen.
I was really amazed to see, if you watch the very end of the game, Messi goes to congratulate their keeper for stopping those France points, whereas everybody else goes to celebrate with the guy who's just scored. And if you watch sort of the aerial of it, it's one guy going in one direction and everybody else going the other direction. And I thought that was such a clear sort of visual representation of how special Messi is. It just sort of blew my mind. And that is the grand total of everything I know about Lionel Messi.
That's a nice observation, though. He's not as big as I thought he was going to be, and he has thighs like fire plugs. Oh, my God, that guy's legs were impressive. Austin also, during the match, texted me and said, Messi's the greatest athlete of all time, don't you agree, or something like that. And maybe
and then Mbappe comes along and scores three goals, and you're
I know. Well, maybe in 12 years, we'll have that conversation again. Donald Trump and his taxes, just very quickly, how much do we know, and will people care, or do they care? Is this the best use of the Justice Department's time, say?
The headline is that we learned that even though the IRS is required by rule to audit the tax returns of the president every year he or she is in office, they did not do so for Donald Trump until 2019, when the democratically controlled Congress asked where those audits were. And I think that raises a lot of questions about partisan control of the IRS and whether the IRS protected the former president from sort of these sort of embarrassing disclosures, which saw that while the president paid $1.1 million while he was in office some years, he paid no federal taxes in 2020, after paying only $750 in taxes in the years before he took office.
Well, and there's also the contention that Trump makes that he didn't pay a lot in taxes because he's smart. And I think he made that argument in one of the debates, even at some point.
He did.
Like, yeah.
Hillary brought it up, and he said, because I'm smart.
Because I'm smart. Okay. So I guess maybe another one of these cases, which is like what he did may not be illegal, but it's what's outrageous is what is legal. And so you might say, well, the IRS tax code needs to be rewritten or altered in ways that so that you don't have people who are making as much money and living as high on the hog as Donald Trump is,
right,
not paying any income taxes. And so it may generate that kind of outrage, but we've known that for years. We've seen wealthy people pay almost nothing in taxes.
Well, that's it. It doesn't seem as scandalous as it maybe once did, and it doesn't seem as scandalous. Nobody's surprised to maybe see what these final numbers are about Donald Trump. That's why I wonder if it would have any resonance in his next campaign, and the campaign that he's running now.
If there's no illegality found in them, if everything is on the up and up, which when it comes to Trump is always
hard to know. Yeah.
But if it's all legal and he just like employs tax dodges, it's like what J.B. Pritzker does in allegedly shielding some of his money here and pulling out the toilets and things like that. I mean, it was legal. I think all of what Pritzker did is legal. But it's like it's what's outrageous is what is legal. How you can hide your assets, you can dodge taxes in various ways. So it's not like it's just Republicans doing this or just Donald Trump doing it. I think wealthy people everywhere shield themselves from taxes, and maybe that's something that needs to be addressed. But I'm not sure that anything's going to come out of this except some throat clearing.
Throat clearing meaning finally we at least knew. I mean, it does finally scratch the itch that a lot of people have had for a long time. I just wonder what's in there. You see it and then you move on. That's kind of how it feels to me right now. It's you guys, I got to wrap this up because I got another meeting to go to. Not that this isn't important to me, not that this isn't a priority, but it's a client to the station, and I said I would be at a meeting at 3:40, and it's 3:41.
Well, get going.
Brandon emailed, I don't know if you saw this, but he got stuck in an interview and couldn't break free. So
I know the feeling. So I'm going to go do that. Brandon couldn't join us for it, but I'm glad you two could. Heather, good to see you and hear
Thanks
you. And Eric,
you.
The same. We are produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. Happy holidays, by the way. I guess next we talk will be, we'll probably do it next Wednesday. Can we all do it next Wednesday, Eric, you think?
I'm off. Yeah. I'm out. Sorry.
I'm around.
Okay. So it'll be me and Eric and whoever else can chime in. We'll drop another pod next week on you. Thank you, kids.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay.
Bye.
I got to click and run.
Very
Thank you.
Happy
bye
holidays.
Now. You too. You too.
So
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.